Thought they had me up in Crown Point like they had Johnny years ago. I thought they had...
Welcome to After Hours, ladies and gentlemen, with me, Rick Cogan. That's the voice of Michael McDermott, who will be performing Saturday at the City Winery in Chicago. He's a great singer-songwriter. He's going to be with a writer, TJ English. They're doing something called Street Lives, Tales of Mobsters, Madness, and Redemption. You're going to hear him all night because, wow, for the first time in a long time, I've got a full show. Thanks to Aubrey Mumpower for engineering here and Elif Garris for producing. All right, I want you to do right now, no matter who you're sitting with, I want you to name two women artists. Okay? Okay. Maybe you mention Georgia O'Keeffe and felt really smart. Maybe Frida Kahlo. Maybe Grandma Moses. Donna Seaman's new book, Identity Unknown, Rediscovering Seven American Women Artists, will change your answer. It is a fantastic book that addresses... Hi, Donna, by the way.
Hi, Rick.
Hi. I want to read something from the book, from this fabulous introduction. Each of these exceptional artists working in Chicago, New York, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C., were highly regarded during their lifetimes, if not nationally, certainly regionally. Collectors and museums purchased their work, but their renown was short-lived. All too soon, their original, daring, and galvanizing paintings and sculptures were forgotten, put in storage, and neatly excised from the pages of art criticism and art history. For decades, there seemed to be room in the American pantheon only for one iconic woman artist, Georgia O'Keeffe. There are many more stories to tell. First, I've got to ask you, and you explain it pretty well in the book, but why and how could that happen? That was a real revelation for me, because I knew some mm-hmm. of the seven artists, and I didn't know all of them, certainly. How and why did that happen?
It is mysterious. I feel that...
It's shameful, too.
It's shameful. It's infuriating. It just seems that women just don't have the staying power in the public consciousness. I think these artists, once they were gone, and some died very young, some lived to be very old, they just weren't taken up by the art critics, by any of the scholars. You know, I started noticing, the most famous artist in the book is Louise Nevelson.
Yes.
She was a superstar. And she died.
A superstar, and also looks like a movie star.
Oh, totally. She was so glamorous,
cool. Yes.
Fascinating. You know, I grew up, revering her. She was everywhere, as I say in the book.
Sure.
And when she died, she was quickly left out of our history books. And that's how this book started.
Is there some kind of, I don't want to make too big a deal of it, but a sexist or misogynistic thing going on here?
No,
I think you
sure.
can make that case, can't
yes,
you?
Yes, sure,
and you do.
It surely seems so, and I do make that case and discuss it. You know, I think it's always very difficult for women to be taken seriously, especially women that live full lives, complicated lives. You know, I think a lot about Georgia O'Keeffe and how she became, the artist.
The woman artist, yeah.
And of course, a magnificent artist. Her work is absolutely exquisite, from her early abstractions to her later landscapes, her famous flowers. She's, powerful, powerful artist. But she also, was famous for many other things. And Alfred Stieglitz, her husband,
yes.
photographer and gallery owner and impresario, really helped establish her right from the start. And then her life after his death, she went to the desert. It's sort of a story we can accept that, a woman went from being this, sort of ravishing young artist to almost like a nun in the desert.
It reminds me, there is this kind of misogynistic thing in all the arts. When Gay Talese, the famous writer, was recently asked what women writers had influenced him in his career, and I think he mentioned, I don't know, Mary McCarthy or somebody, and could not think of anyone else.
Yes.
Was this initially, when you started this process, and this book is so fabulously researched and so fabulously written, how long did this take?
Well, two of the there's
what and what was the I want to read something else if you don't mind.
Oh, I'm not of course I don't mind. I love
I'm not going to read this whole all the way through this show, but I'm going to have what Donna Seaman will do after this first segment is give us like 3 or 4 minutes on each one of these fascinating because you make them all not just richly detailed lives, but also fascinating in. The way that, you know, maybe not as nutty as Jackson Pollock or somebody, but there are edges
there are edges.
Yeah, you will hear 7 really amazing stories. But Donna also writes in this fabulous introduction, I grew up watching a woman artist at work, my mother, Elaine Seaman. I witnessed firsthand what it meant for an artist to perform the daily balancing act between caring for one's family and home, something that Picasso never had to do, and the demands of art. I understood early on that the need to create is deep, inexplicable, and persistent, and that it can be a source of both pleasure and angst. I saw that making art required solitary communion as well as communal support. Obviously, your mother is a huge inspiration to you.
That's right. You know, when you asked me how long this took, you know, the honest answer would be my entire life.
Yeah, exactly.
It
sure.
starts
sure.
early. And I was a very fortunate child to grow up in a house, a loving house, loving household, that valued art and books and creativity and curiosity. And my mother did, you know, put full effort into every aspect of her life. So the house was beautiful, and her art was beautiful, and her
marriage was
happy.
Her kids were smart and beautiful.
Well, I don't know about that.
Well.
But, Mom would say so. But art was – so she approached all of life as a work of art, and all aspects of it were very important to her. And that made a huge impression on me, of course. Also, her work is very unusual, quite exquisite, and innovative. She used an unusual medium that most fine artists do not use, called scratchboard. So that was just part of I just thought that was, you know, that art and life were paired.
So growing up and being inspired from an early age, at what point did you say to yourself, excuse me, I think there's a book that I need. Did you feel the need? You must have felt the need to write it, didn't you?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I always wanted to be a writer.
Yeah, well, and you're a great writer.
Oh,
right?
Thank you, Rick.
What's your title? Senior editor?
Well, I'm now editor adult books, which
at
has kind of a funny. Yes, at Booklist.
And there is no, I must tell you, being in the book world in Chicago, there is no greater advocate for the written world than Donna Seaman in this town.
Oh, thank you.
There are a couple others, and they're all friends of ours.
Exactly.
But she is it.
Them.
She is really it tonight. She's a terrific, terrific critic and writer. So when do you pull the trigger on this book?
So, you know, I think it was probably about 10 years ago. I wrote two of these. There's 7 profiles in this book.
Yeah.
I wrote 2 of them a while ago, certainly before I had a book contract. Louise Nevelson was the first one, and she was the impetus because I watched her disappear as an art student. I mean, by the time I came to Chicago.
And you were mystified by that.
I was.
Yeah.
And it struck me as something that I needed to think about and try to figure out. Also, I just wanted to write about her work. You know, I love writing about literature. I love writing about books. But I wanted something different, to kind of stretch a little bit. And so early on, I had this idea of writing about women artists. And I had all kinds of lists and ideas. I wrote about Louise Nevelson. I wrote about Ree Morton, who's another sculptor.
Yeah.
Oh, her work. Another artist whose work just always intrigued me.
And the nice thing about the book, too, is there are ample examples. And, all, you know, that's one of – I'm not a big internet person, but one of the great things about a book like this is you can Google it. People do. Before we take a break and we'll get into the 7 profiles, you also write in here, Donna, you write, these are narrative stories. Donna Seaman is such a talented writer that that Identity Unknown reads like a series of great Vanity Fair profiles or New Yorker profiles. They're very compelling because these women are fascinating. But she does write, and she's correct here, this is not a book of art criticism, nor is it a feminist polemic, though feminist I am. I wrote about these artists to learn more about their lives and spend more time immersed in their art. I wanted to discover what drove them, what obsessed them, what art meant to them, and how they lived and how they worked. She has done that with seven remarkable people, and we're going to, I'm going to ask her to pretend that she's in a meeting with a movie producer and give me like 4 minutes on each of them. You're going to hear about each one of the seven American women artists. He will be at City Winery with author T.J. English Saturday night. Go to citywinerychicago.com. Okay, Donna Seaman, author of Identity Unknown, Rediscovering Seven American Women Artists. Let's go.
All right. The seven. We'll begin with Louise Nevelson, who we've talked about a little bit. Famous for her great outfits, her long false eyelashes, her turbans, her gutsiness. Louise was a late bloomer. She came to art in her 50s. She was born in Russia, Jewish-Russian immigrant as a girl, ended up in Rockport, Maine, which actually was Edna St. Vincent Millay's hometown, and she couldn't wait to get out of there either. Her father, interestingly enough, ran a junkyard and a sort of a lumber business.
Yeah.
And given Louise's later work building with wood, kind of interesting. She started making her own clothes as a young girl. She always presented herself and mythologized herself in a interesting artistic way. She had very little money after she left her very wealthy husband and would go out in New York City late at night and pick up scraps of wood out of in the streets and the alleys, bring them home, paint them black, and build these incredible monumental works of great detail. She had boxes and would fill them with these scraps, and they were so organic and intricate and moody, and they were totemic.
And powerful, too.
So
I remember
powerful.
Seeing a few shows of hers that just bowled me over.
The Art Institute of Chicago used to have a whole enormous piece of hers for years and years. It's been put away for decades. And then Louise got very famous late in life. She also did large public sculptures and worked with metal, you know, went to fabrication shops, and I can just picture her bossing guys around. She's always smoking.
Yeah.
I can just imagine the conversations. And she knew Andy Warhol and John Cage, and she was everywhere.
Well, Edward Albee, the famous playwright, who was a great friend of hers, called her. He said she was a bird of rare plumage. And her work sold.
Oh, she was enormously successful.
Enormously successful. What do you think? Do you think, now that I do want to cover all seven of these.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to get carried away.
What do you think, and you know these women intimately enough now, I think, Donna Seaman, what do you think they would make of their relative obscurity now?
Oh.
I know it's hard to generalize,
yeah.
But I think Nevelson would be...
Oh, she'd be crushed.
Yeah.
Appalled. Furious.
Yeah.
And that's what Edward Albee wrote a beautiful play about this called The Occupant.
Yeah.
Because he saw it. He saw it happen when he was still around. It was such a complete reversal. So Louise would have been very angry and indignant, and rightfully so.
So I'm telling you people out there, just write these names down, or just go buy the book and then start Googling. But write the names down, or just Google the book Identity Unknown, and you'll get all, you can then order it. and you can get all these names and you start looking at the artwork. There are marvelous photos and reproductions of some of the art, a lot of the artwork, frankly. An incredible picture of Nevelson with, of course, a cigarette in her hands. Gertrude Abercrombie.
Oh, Gertrude Abercrombie. Now, Gertrude was very well known in Chicago and not much further than
right,
our area here.
Right.
She was the queen of Bohemia in Hyde Park. Her house, she
and
was...
And that takes a lot to be the queen of Bohemia in Hyde Park.
And she worked hard at it, I believe. Gertrude was born to opera stars that were part of a traveling troupe.
Yeah, yeah.
She herself was a very good piano player, a good pianist. She married an attorney, and they had a brownstone in Hyde Park, which became Jazz Central. It was sort of a salon. And this was in the heyday when Chicago really had a jazz scene.
Oh, sure.
And this was also the 40s and when whites and blacks did not always mix socially. So Gertrude was, you know, a pioneer in opening her life to everyone. And she became really good friends with Dizzy Gillespie and Sonny Rollins and Sarah Vaughan. And she, in the book, I have a list of jazz musicians who stayed at her house. It was sort of, you know, a little bit of a hotel or a bed and breakfast, if you will, although I don't think there was a lot of breakfast going on. She wasn't much of a cook.
It was a very early breakfast.
Like after you've been up all night. But she painted constantly, and she painted these wonderfully eerie, atmospheric paintings that were, many of them are self-portraits, and she turned herself into this sort of symbolic figure, a little austere, usually haunted in appearance. And she loved these sort of prairie landscapes. She didn't paint the city, interestingly enough.
That was interesting to me.
She loved Alito, Illinois, which is near Mississippi. And so the landscape really looks like that area. And barren, everything sort of stripped trees often, or trees kind of huddled and cowering beneath the big moon. Lots of strange clouds and interesting, very... Her palette was very limited, but so perfectly right for the Midwest and Chicago.
Yeah, they called her Queen Gertrude.
And she had a whole sort of set of symbols she was interested in, a lot of letters in her. She was a lonely person. She had a lot of letters in her paintings and telephones off the hook and paintings within paintings. They tell a story. She really was painting her inner autobiography.
Yeah, this is hers was some life. I mean, not just the, you know, the list of people whom she knew. I mean, this was a woman who was incredibly engaged.
She was
in life,
always an artist, always painting, always thinking of imagery, and very committed to the whole idea of creativity. She helped a lot of people, supported a lot of people. She loved the outdoor art shows, the Hyde Park Art Fair. She loved being out among other artists and people interested in art. She was a great conversationalist. She had a wicked sense of humor.
Let me ask you, Donna, I'm going to keep you here
until
10. We're going to get to all of these remarkable women. Why seven?
Well, originally I had a much longer list, but I got carried away and these pieces got longer and longer. And so I thought...
Well, that I can understand because these lives are... You know, it wasn't like, oh, you know, Helen Jones went to art school and then she married a lawyer who allowed her to paint in the living room. They are
exactly.
So much vaster and complex than that.
As we'll see. I mean, Gertrude was somewhat of a recluse, but the other women in this book were world travelers and really adventurous. So, and I've always liked the number seven, actually.
Yeah, it's quite a book. We're going to move on to... I love the titles of the chapters, too. Behind the Masks is the next one.
Junkie girl in my world, and everything began to twirl, and it spun so that I could.
Once again, Michael McDermott, you're hearing him all night. He'll be doing a show called Storytellers. He's singing, and author T.J. English will be reading. It's called Street Lives, Tales of Mobsters, Madness, and Redemption. Donna Seaman is here with me. She is the author of Identity Unknown, Rediscovering Seven American Women Artists. I try to emphasize American and women there. We have only gotten two of them so far. Donna's going to be at the Harold Washington Library on the 21st of March with our mutual friend Billy Lombardo, a great writer and a great teacher as well. It's a show at 6 o'clock where she will probably be showing some slides of these artists and talking about their lives as she is doing now. Okay, next. Next up, Behind the Masks.
Behind the Masks, Lois Mailou Jones. A fascinating woman, born in Boston in 1905, African-American. Family summered on Martha's Vineyard, where there was quite the arts gathering.
Sure. As always, yeah. And Philip became just nothing but rich people.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
She became very good friends with Dorothy West, who was part of the Harlem Renaissance. Lois was a prodigy. Studied
she
at
was
the
also,
museum school.
And this is the depth of your research. She was also something of a great baseball player,
basketball player, an athlete. Very athletic, extremely athletic. She was multi-talented, multifaceted, very disciplined, worked very hard. She initially was designing fabrics and had great success with that, and then found that that was somewhat limiting. She an interesting way got herself to Howard University, where she became a teacher and had a long 40-year career there, and got a sabbatical to Paris in the 1930s at the height of the Josephine era, whom she met Josephine, and painted gorgeous impressionistic sort of paintings in Paris scenes, became very close friends with a French woman. They traveled the countryside. Extraordinarily gorgeous work. Came back to the States in the late 30s. Wanted to submit a painting to a juried exhibition at the Corcoran Gallery, which is a public institution in Washington, D.C., and she could not because she was black.
Black, yeah.
And so charming. She had her friend, yeah, charming, we're so proud of this. So she had her white friend bring the work in, and the work won a prize. So that sort of thing kept Lois very determined to be accepted as an artist, not as a woman artist, not as an African-American artist, but as an artist.
But you just imagine, you bring it to the fore in this chapter, too, about that struggle is just, talk about someone with the resilience to carry on, not only in the face of the discrimination that a woman artist would have felt, but an African or a black artist would have felt, too, to not just say, oh, the hell with it. You know what I mean?
not Lois.
No,
she was
no
a
kidding.
Fighter.
I know.
And what she did, she was so brilliant. And one of her escape routes was to travel to Africa. She turned herself into like an art ambassador. She had amazing trips over there. She introduced African artists to African-American artists' work and vice versa. Her paintings changed dramatically, where she was influenced by African masks and by the fabrics she saw. And I titled this Behind the Mask because Lois wore many masks to protect herself and to work in different environments. She then, late in life, in her 40s, married a man, an artist, from Haiti, which became another place. And, of course, she was really liberated outside of this country. In France, she was treated just as an artist.
Sure.
And
sure.
In Africa, of course, that was a world she was thrilled to be in, and there was no question of belonging or not belonging. Also in Haiti. And she was very inspired by the countryside there and by the art and by voodoo. And she incorporated that in her paintings, too. And she was so innovative. Her style changed over and over again.
Donna, in doing these profiles and researching these profiles, and you obviously knew a bit going in, were you not increasingly impressed by the, not only, I don't want to make too much of it, the sort of courage of the sort of courage spurred by curiosity that almost every one of these seven displayed?
Exactly.
They're heroic.
They are heroic. They were courageous. Their conviction was so deep and profound. There were so many incidents in life and attitudes towards them that could have deflected their artistic progress. And they refused, to a woman, to give in to any of that.
Yeah.
And I did. And my appreciation for their work, which I loved to begin with grew and grew and grew.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. Okay, the Rebellious Bravo.
Which is a line from one of Ree Morton's notebooks.
You also, the book is, your book, Identity Unknown, is so beautifully illustrated. There is the cutest picture here of this woman in kindergarten in 1941. Okay, who's she?
She was adorable. So Ree Morton grew up not too far from where I did, and she was from Ossining, New York. She thought she was going to be a nurse, but realized that the sight of blood made her ill. And she married a naval officer quite young, and they traveled a lot, and she had three children. And she was home ironing one day, and there was one of those how to paint shows on public television.
Yeah,
and she thought,
yeah,
you know what? I need to see this.
I mean,
is that classic?
I hope, ladies and gentlemen, you were finding these stories as charming. These are, you know, Donna Seaman has a great, great sense of story and storytelling. And she brings each one of these women to life in what is like a, you know, a mini episode of some kind of fabulous TV series.
Oh, if only.
Well, I think that would be great if you could find somebody to find one. Meryl Streep as
absolutely
all of them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Meryl right. Streep as all of them. But they all, you know, keep going about, yeah,
so,
about
her. So Ree Morton established her first studio in a little corner in the basement near the washing machine and began making these amazingly quirky, funny, incisive sculptures out of scraps of things, kind of like Louise Nevelson.
Yeah. You know,
these women had no money. They had no resources. It was hard to make art. It's hard to afford a studio. And but Ree Morton realized as soon as she started making things that this was her life, she was able to, she separated from her husband and went to the Tyler Academy of Art in Philadelphia, had great teachers who recognized her genius really immediately. And she just kept working. And she was another one where she had so many influences. She was very influenced by literature. She was a big reader. Very intellectual work, very funny, a lot of language,
well,
puns.
Another thing that distinguishes, I think, all of them, and I hate to make blanket judgments about all of them, but all of them had this kind of desperate taste for life,
yes,
in all of its facets, and were not at all loath, rather eager to incorporate everything they found into what they did and created.
Really well put. Absolutely. Music, sunsets, food, their children.
People,
friends.
Places.
Travel.
Yeah.
Ree Morton became an itinerant teacher. She traveled all around the country and was fascinated by everywhere she went and made art based on where she was. That's how spontaneously creative she could be. Remarkable person.
Joan Brown,
yes. San Francisco, an only child, a peculiarly wretched childhood, which she tried to escape by spending many hours in the library reading about ancient Egypt. That became a huge influence on her. She hadn't really thought about being an artist until she kind of wandered over to the San Francisco Art Institute campus and saw a lot of cute guys playing bongos and thought, this is the place for me.
That's so great. That's such a great story.
I love Joan Brown. She was really a brave and daring individual. She went home to create her portfolio. She had no idea what a portfolio
exactly
would be.
Exactly, I know.
So she had some typing paper and drew portraits of movie stars based on magazines. And being in the 1960s and being in San Francisco, they accepted her. I'm not sure any other art school would have. And she turned out to be immensely talented, was exhibiting when she was just 20, abstract expressionist paintings, lushly. She would be covered from head to toe in paint and had galleries and great success with that. And then abruptly decided to change her style. Joan Brown never did anything except what she felt she had to do. She was also a really brave swimmer and would swim in the San Francisco Bay in terrifying conditions. She was a very small person, but did really big things. And
well, again, it's that notion of courage.
Oh.
That notion of courage.
And daring.
An interesting-looking woman, too.
Oh, well,
a very interesting-looking woman.
Stunning.
Looks like a very San Francisco of the time.
Absolutely of the time, right in the heart of the art scene. But changed her style to a figurative, very flat, you could hardly see the brush stroke. She did lots of self-portraits, as Gertrude did, but Joan Brown's were more projected outward. They weren't as deeply psychological.
She
as
has.
Churches.
I read this a couple of weeks ago. She has perhaps the largest chapter. Does she?
Joan has her life. She traveled all over the world. She ended up making public sculpture. She had quite a few marriages. Her life was episodically complicated over and over again, remaking herself. And one thing about Joan Brown that was of real interest is that she made a woman's life subject for fine art. She painted everything she went through, including her final phase of being deeply spiritual, which actually led to her death.
Fascinating. We've got two more, I think, two more. Will get to them in a moment. You got to take a short little break, and then we'll be back, and we'll finish up with you, too. If you people are not intrigued enough to go out and buy this book, like tonight, I know you can't go to a bookstore, but there are other ways to buy a book. Please do so. Then you're just not listening. I mean, the great thing about Donna and her book is she makes these stories really and these people really come alive. We'll be right back. Once again, I hope you're enjoying listening to Michael McDermott. He's quite a singer-songwriter. He'll be at City Winery Saturday night with TJ English. It's a combination of song and stories, tales of mobsters, madness, and redemption. So just like perfect for Chicago. Okay, Donna Seaman, we are down to the final two. Christina Ramberg, the American woman artist you knew.
I did know Christina. Christina was a student at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago and then became a professor there. And she was an extraordinary individual, and I was really happy to have known her. So that made writing this kind of different than writing the others, much
was
more
it,
intense.
Did it make it easier or harder?
Oh, no, it was
harder, much harder.
Well,
yeah,
especially
sure.
because Christina died young, and her loss was so painful to me. And she's another reason I wanted to write this book. I wanted to write about Christina. Christina made amazing paintings about the body, about the female body. She painted she didn't paint faces. She painted the torsos of bodies. Some resemble sort of S&M type scenarios, but with a very interesting twist, because I feel that really these are women of figures of tremendous female power,
no question,
and possession and assurance. And she made other torsos that were much more vulnerable, sort of peeled back images of the body. There's almost like medical illustration details. These are very psychological works as well, about, you know, deep inner conflicts and feelings of vulnerability. She was an impeccable painter, such gorgeous detail, such surface.
And she wrote, too.
Sensitive.
I mean, she would write.
She wrote. She was a brilliant teacher. She was... her whole family was really into lists and cataloging. One of her sisters is a scientist, another is a librarian. So Christina had this wonderful resource where she kept all these files on all these different subjects. She worked from everything from comic books to medical illustrations and advertisements, you know, the Sears catalog. And her sense of detail came from all those sort of graphic arts. And
you mention, memory serves in the book, that she is sort of in the process of being rediscovered.
She is.
That's a nice thing.
You know, over the years I worked on this book, I was not the only person interested in these artists, including Christina Ramberg. Christina is represented by a great gallery here in Chicago, Corbett versus Dempsey. Mm-hmm. So her work, and she does have work in the Art Institute of Chicago, happily.
Yeah.
So I feel that, you know, when we need artists, we retrieve them. They come back for us. And so I think I was tuned in to something that other people interested in art have been tuned into. And, you know, you mentioned the internet. You know, people are sharing works on Pinterest, and people are blogging about these artists. There's been shows now that are starting to come back.
Yeah.
Including the seventh artist we're going to talk about, Lenore Tawney, who was a fiber artist who lived in Chicago for a long time and started her work here. whose work was put away and disappeared. In fact, the whole fiber art movement was kind of forgotten.
Gone. Yeah.
And now it's coming back. I saw a show in New York that had a lot of fiber art in it. There was a traveling exhibition that Lenore was in. Lenore Tawney was friends with Agnes Martin, so there's sort of renewed interest.
And she taught in her. Claire Zeisler one.
Yes,
too. Yeah.
Claire Zeisler, another Chicago fiber artist. So I feel that their time is coming back, that the cycle is turning.
Well, I will tell you, Donna Seaman, that your book is going a long way and will go a long way to bring these women back to the position they deserve. I mean, I would love, good luck, the Art Institute to do a show based on this. I mean, I would.
Wouldn't that be magnificent?
It would be fantastic. But you must be not only proud of this book, are you?
Yes. Yes, I am. Thank you.
The notion that you've done these women just a great service, and you've done their art a great service.
That's so important to me. I felt tremendous responsibility towards these artists and their families and estates. So that was my really big concern, you know, to tell the stories straight, to tell the truth, but also with great respect. And
well, in dealing with the families, which you had to do, the heirs to all this, how did they feel about it when you would talk about? Well, I want to write about your mom, sister, aunt, whatever. Any reluctance from family members? I can't imagine.
No, quite the opposite. I had tremendous support, you know, especially with Christina Ramberg's family, who were, you know, that was the story that I did the most, you know, interviews with.
Oh, sure.
You know, actual reporting, kind of. And they were so generous and open and pleased, you know, really participating, and it's painful. You know, I lost my sister too, so I know what it's like to deal with that. And yet you always want to talk about your loved one. And
let me ask
you
before I let you go, and thank you for spending this whole hour talking
about Identity Unknown.
Stop. Rediscovering Seven American Women Artists. Fantastic book. Again, Donna will be at the Harold Washington Library at 6 o'clock on the 21st. Of March. You will also be at the Seminary Co-op on the 29th, then Milwaukee, for those of you listening in Milwaukee, on the 30th,
yes.
And you'll be in Poughkeepsie. I don't think we have any listeners in Poughkeepsie.
Probably not.
She'll be at the Printers Row Lit Fest in June. For book list, you write relatively short.
I do.
They are paragraphs, they are artful, but they are reviews, and they're short. What was it like? Was it joyful, intimidating, scary, frustrating, intimidating? What to write at this length?
It was thrilling. It was exhilarating. I felt like I've been let out of a cage, frankly. That's why these got the way they are. It was, and that was really exciting to me. I mean, I didn't doubt really that I could do it,
right.
But I was, you know, I wasn't sure. And I really went crazy. I just was.
I don't think you went crazy.
No,
you went crazy.
It was
thrilled. It flowed then.
It did. I mean, it. You know, you asked me if I'm proud of the book. I'm also kind of stunned to see it as a book.
Sure.
You know what that's like.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, I didn't have a leave. I did this while I was working. And I, you know, our jobs at Booklist are very demanding.
Oh, yeah.
Take a lot of hours. I do a lot of reading for that job. And so now I kind of wonder how I did this, actually. I know that, as the women artists in the book did, I was just determined.
Well, my words aside, and my you have gotten some astonishing, they call them endorsements. I still like to call them jacket blurbs, and you've gotten dozens, and I'm sure that people are going to be the more people who read it, the more people are going to be overwhelmed by it.
I was so grateful for these.
And the great thing is, Donna, you did these women proud. And it's still you've sort of, you've come close to solving, the mystery, I think. I mean, I think it's a misogynistic, too many male art critics. Who knows why? people vanish. I mean, I'm sure you could talk to
we could a whole nother hour.
we could do another hour, and we could call a bunch of Hollywood actresses and see what their problem is too. But you did these seven women proud. We gave you little snapshots of them. You've got to get the whole book to get the full stories, and each one of the stories is fascinating on its own. On its own. I literally think you could do smaller kind of biographies of each one of these
definitely.
People.
Definitely.
You
have done, believe me.
You have done what they used to call in The New Yorker profiles, and they are artful, and they are compelling, and they are really, really entertaining. And that's the bottom line.
Oh, I can't thank you enough,
bro. Donna, it's great to see you. She'll be with the great Billy Lombardo March 21st, 6 o'clock at the Harold Washington Library. But go out beforehand. Buy the book, Identity Unknown. You can buy it there, but it'd be nice to come in with a copy that you've read and say, Donna, could you sign this for me? Donna, it's great to see you.
Oh,
safe
travels. Wonderful,
home,
Rick.
Honey.
Thank you so
much. Oh, my pleasure. We're going to talk to Kevin Davis about his fascinating book of a very, very different kind about courtroom hijinks. And it's called The Brain Defense Murder in Manhattan and the Dawn of Neuroscience in America's Courtrooms.